Hi, I'm Bill Arnold. Thank you for listening to this podcast of Real Recovery. There are many more podcasts available at myfaithradio.com. Your support makes this possible. Thank you.
Help, I need somebody. Help, not just anybody. Help, you know I need someone. Help.
When I was young, all right, it is time. Welcome to Real Recovery. I'm so glad that you've joined us tonight. Bill Arnold here in studio and at his home studio facing the lake, sitting in his most comfortable chair, George P. Fraser. Hello, George.
Billy, how are you?
How old is that lounge chair you're sitting in? And have you ever had it cleaned?
20 years.
Yeah.
And yeah,
oh,
I
good.
Have had it cleaned. Doesn't look like it, but
well, yeah,
it's
but
good enough for me, kind of like the rest of my place.
20-some years old, it's not going to be looking great, but does your dog jump in that chair when you're not in it?
No, but it goes with the piles of magazines and newspapers I have on the floor. I've got that path through them, you know?
Yeah.
And it's kind of nice. I'm really looking forward to the show tonight.
Why is that?
Well, we've had her on before, and she has a great story, and she tells it very well.
Yes, definitely. And our guest, Janet, we'll bring her on a little bit later, time permitting, of course.
If we have time.
If we have time. Yeah. And she's going to talk about her very exciting week, where this week she had her 8th anniversary of sobriety.
And that's a huge deal. Anytime anybody gets sober, it's a miracle.
Mm-hmm.
And we know where miracles come from, Bill.
Mm-hmm. So, George, I got a verse out of 1 Corinthians I want to share. It's chapter 10, verse 12. It says, "So if you think you are standing firm, be careful that you don't fall." And I thought, huh, that might be a nice verse to tie into step 10, which I hope we talk about tonight.
Yeah, it's let every man take heed lest he stumble. Pride comes before the fall, doesn't it?
Uh-huh.
And I want to simplify that and get it to my level, which requires simplification. When I hear myself, I don't need to do that anymore. I've got this. I think the steps are circular. And of course, step 10 is continue to take our personal inventory. And when we were wrong, we promptly admitted it. So if they're circular, Bill, I go back to step 1, where I admit I'm powerless and that my life is unmanageable because I'm trying to run it. And I take step 10 and go, okay, did I do what I wanted today? Am I sober today? Am I following my lists of non-negotiables? Did I get enough sleep? Did I work out? Am I eating right? Did I have my prayer time, workouts, etc., whatever on your list? And usually if things aren't going well, you'll find that you neglected something. You forgot to do it. That's easy to correct. Promptly admit means not verbalizing it. It's doing it, fixing it, making it right. But I have to go back to step 1 and go, hey, I am powerless over my anger or other issues, and I got angry today. And I said a couple things, probably 5 that I could have reloaded and didn't do it. My mentor, Denny, always says to me, just because you think it, doesn't mean you have to do it, which has, you know, really been good.
Yeah.
And what we're working on now is just because you think it, George, you don't have to say it. Not nearly as much fun as life used to be for me,
yeah,
but a lot of less time fixing it. So what we want to also look at is, what is God doing in my life? Are you sober? You didn't do that. Are you saved? Hey, you know what? You didn't do that one either. So the pride that you talk about goes away when we look at God is doing for us what we can't do for ourselves. What do you think?
Well, I think that's a great way to look at step 10. And I'm also thinking of the idea that the alcoholism is a progression, and there's usually little incremental steps that happen along the way. And I think when we hear Janet's story tonight, I know we're going to hear about a restoration, which is really exciting, because I know you often quote John 10:10, the thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy, but I have come that they may have life and have it to the full. I think of a restored life is back having it to the full. And that progressive alcoholism is stealing and killing your life and your joy. And you are living with a certain level of delusion until you come to your senses.
Yeah, and the delusion doesn't go away just because you stop drinking. We are prone to delusion, Bill. Jesus said, I am the way, I am the truth, okay? And we were talking about Genesis 3. That's the delusion and the trick. And we've got to stay in the truth and live the truth. And as we're using, our lies increase. We have secrets. We don't share everything with our core group. And we might develop a new core group because we don't have to lie to them. And this is the process. And it, the progression that you talk about just isn't in quantity consumed and days that I get high. It's all the defects of lying, secrets that start, they accumulate.
Mm-hmm. So, George, you can't even really begin to have an awareness of taking personal inventory. And when you're wrong, promptly admitting it if you're in your using phase. It's not until you get some sobriety that you can understand step 10. Is that right? Is that fair?
Interestingly, we always take our inventory, I think, in recovery or before, but this time we're doing it honestly. So your question's right, Bill, in that if I'm lying to everybody, that has to start with a lie to myself. I believe that whenever I lie to myself first, that it's okay to lie to somebody else and to lie to God. Mm-hmm. So it builds, and then you don't know who you are or what you are anymore. And what we forget is we're redeemed children of God, that we're bought with our price, bought with a price. We're not our own anymore. We're a new creation in Christ. And children of the King don't go around lying and eating out of garbage cans and living on the street. But that's where we get. And so we need to remember who we are. But when you're in an active state of addiction, you lose who you are. You mm-hmm. can't focus.
Mm-hmm. And George, how important is it that you have a support system that comes alongside you and helps get you to the point of taking that first step towards recovery?
Oh, very. And God puts those people in our lives. Unfortunately, a lot of times our support system in our mind becomes our enemy because they hold us accountable.
Mm.
And, you know, the most dreaded words in my recovery is, I love you too much to let you keep on doing it this to yourself. And I remember thinking, if you really love me, you'd leave me alone, you know? My dad's been dead for 17 years, and I'm more and more grateful every year. There's no way I'd be sober if I didn't have a dad who was tough.
So, yeah, he gave you the tough love, and that was critical for your recovery, wasn't it?
Well, yeah, but not at the time. I wasn't jumping up and down with it, going, gosh, thanks for telling me I got a drug problem. I didn't know it.
Yeah.
You're so brilliant and so caring. And yeah, but unless that happens, somebody needs to get the truth through your head. One of the recovery books talks about being beaten into a state of reasonableness. And that was my experience.
Yeah. And you share your story well, George. I am always glad to hear your story. And I think we should hear it at least once a year on Real Recovery, just not tonight.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah, I mean, because we have a guest, and we definitely want to take a break and bring her on and let her tell her story, because it's going to be a celebration, because this week she got her 8-year chip. Am I saying that right?
That's so nice. Yeah. And it's always nice to have somebody back on the program to hear, you know, further success.
I agree. I mean, to think about it, when we started our program 10 years ago, she was actively using. And then 2 years into our program, we she started her sobriety, and now she here she is tonight telling her story. So we'll take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery, Bill and George. We have Ryan on the board, as competent as ever. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery, Bill and George. George, we had a fantastic story coming up tonight. I'm very excited once again to be hearing from our guest, Janet, who's going to be on in just a second. We don't very often have guests who are coming on celebrating their anniversary date of sobriety, so this is going to be fun tonight.
You know, we should do this more often to check back with people, because different times in your walk, in your recovery, things change and you need to adapt to them.
Mm-hmm. And Janet is celebrated 8 years on Thursday. So we're excited to hear the journey and to be celebrating along with her. Janet, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you for having me.
Yeah. Just because we haven't had you on in years and years, we do want to hear once again your story that got you into the place where you needed to start a recovery program.
Yes, and I'm happy to tell it.
I know you would
be. Where do you want me to start?
Start, you know, where you're most comfortable.
All right. Well, let's see. I grew up in a family where alcohol really wasn't present. Occasionally, my parents would have a glass of wine with dinner, but it wasn't something I grew up around. It wasn't a problem for my parents or any of my other family members. And, you know, in high school, I kind of ran around with the crowd that we would occasionally do some drinking on a Friday or a Saturday night. But again, it wasn't a huge thing. College, kind of the same thing. It was a fun weekend thing. And, you know, nobody was ever out doing anything crazy, just a little goofiness. And it was really when I was in my 20s that it really started to take off as a way for me to calm down. I'm a pretty high-strung person and looked forward to the end of the day to have a few drinks and unwind, and didn't think too much of it. I have no idea when it crossed from being a social drinker to the problem that it became. And I don't spend too much time worrying about that, because if you find yourself in a hole, you don't think about how'd you get there. You want to get out. And it became very clear to me, but I pushed it away, that alcohol was starting to take root and control my life. And at first I denied it was a problem. Oh, I just drink a little bit more than everybody else, but you know, I could knock that off whenever I want to, or, you know, it's my friend. I'm just relaxing and having a few drinks at night. And, then somewhere it changed and it really took control of my life.
The key word I hear is relaxation. And after a long, busy day, if you feel like you need to relax, it was a natural step to take that got out of control.
Right. Well, it does as advertised. It worked. It would calm me down.
Mm-hmm.
But I come to find out later when I did go to treatment that I had undiagnosed anxiety. And this anxiety had propelled me to be a 4.0 student, very successful, very smart through undergrad, grad school. I had these advanced degrees. I couldn't be an alcoholic. And so that part of the denial really took hold, and I didn't want to face that I was actually relying and self-medicating with alcohol to even just get through my days. And it was very strong. And even when family and friends were pointing it out to me, I switched over into hiding it. And so what looked like I was having a glass of wine, I was actually having three. And I didn't want to be bothered with people telling me, oh, you know, this is becoming more than just what other people are doing around me. So the hiding it became more frequent, drinking earlier in the day, you know, all the things that are classic signs of alcoholism were happening to me, and I just didn't want to see it.
George, now you ask an interesting question.
Well, I want to go back to high school, and I want to qualify this before I ask the question, because did it. But I saw you said, you know, you drank a little in high school, and, you know, that's what the cool kids did. Was that legal at the time?
Oh, no. No, okay. It was not. We were just kind of creative about how we get our hands on alcohol, and we were always at somebody's house, we weren't out with fake IDs, and it was the same group of people, so it wasn't like we were encountering new groups of people. It was just kind of my same group of friends, and we thought we were being responsible. Nobody drove. So it was just kind of fun time. I don't know. Silliness.
There's a bigger question here, and once again, I did it too. But with the competence, Bill, with the graduate degrees, the 4.0, which I think is overkill when you get that high grade point, but that's a whole nother show. we have a level of competence here, and rules are kind of negotiable for us because we have an ability. And so if other people are saying, hey, you know, you're drinking, hey, look at what I'm doing. I do everything. Yeah. And I think it's a mindset.
Yeah, it's a high functioning capabilities, Janet, isn't it?
It is. And when I was pregnant with both of my children, I stopped drinking completely. So I thought, well, I can't be an alcoholic because look, I stopped for 9 months here. I stopped for 9 months there. I stopped while I was breastfeeding. There's no way I could be an alcoholic because look what else I can do. And it crept right back in.
So you had places and spaces in your life where you could put it aside, and that was kind of giving you some false assurance that this is not a problem. And you probably would use that in your discussions with loved ones as well. How could it be
right.
a problem? I didn't drink when I was pregnant.
Right. And now, you know, I'm a mom with two little kids, and the whole mom culture of, oh, it's cute. Mom grabs a glass of wine, you know, because she's watching Elmo on Sesame Street, you know, who doesn't need that to get through Sesame Street? So there was the culture of, oh, it's okay. It's kind of cute and funny. And I clung to that for a while. And that was a defense as well. I'm not doing anything that other moms aren't doing. And when in reality, it was, like I said, people would think I was having a glass of wine, and I had bottles stashed where I was getting more, but they only saw the bottle in the kitchen that really wasn't very much drank out of it. So,
So you must have also gotten good at creating fiction.
Very good at creating fiction, even fiction to myself.
Okay.
Another word for that is lying.
I'm aware of that, George.
And the process really starts, Bill, slowly. Seems harmless, and I think we're going to hear it build here to where it becomes a huge problem.
Absolutely, yes. I can't even describe how slowly it, as George was saying, it just became an everyday thing to be lying about it and constantly thinking about where am I going to get my next drink? How am I going to hide these bottles? I can now look back and say, if you are having a relationship with a dumpster near your house where you know you can dump bottles so they're not found by your loved ones, that's a problem. And I didn't understand. I'd see people at the checkout with a six-pack of beer and think, well, that's not even enough to get started. Why would you even bother? You know, you should be getting a case of beer. Or you don't need one bottle of wine. You need to be getting six. So I even those things that in my head, I'm like, well, that person doesn't even know how to drink. You know, obviously should have been a clue, but I just laughed it off as, oh, these people, what lightweights.
So how would you go about disposing bottles in a clandestine sort of way? Not that I not that I know what the word clandestine means, but I thought I'd use it.
Oh, I had all sorts of ways. I would hide them in the basement until I knew I could get them out of the house without clinking, bothering anyone, and, and fill a garbage bag and take them to where, you know, an apartment complex where I could throw them in a dumpster. I mean, it was just, it was really ridiculous when I think about how much mental energy it took to get the alcohol, to hide the bottles, to drink it, to try not to act drunk, even though I'm a dead giveaway, according to my husband, when I've been drinking. And it was just a whole way of life. And I really didn't, as it became apparent that it was a problem and that alcohol had its hooks in me deeper than I knew, I didn't know how I was going to stop it.
Did it scare you one day that that was normal to you? How did I get here?
Yes. And again, the guilt of, but I had a great childhood, but I had a wonderful supportive family. I have everything I ever wanted, a great husband, two kids. I've got a career I've been building. I can't, this can't be me. So what's wrong with me? So then the guilt compounded and I drink just to today. I'll just drink to get through today. And of course, today becomes every day over quite a long period of time. And it was exhausting.
Jenna, did you have any consequences to talk about at this point for the choices that you were making?
The consequences of the loss of trust with my husband, with my parents, my siblings, my friends. I don't know how, but I was never picked up for drinking and driving. Mm-hmm. I did most of my drinking at home, but I do remember times when I'd run out of alcohol and slip out late at night and drive when I shouldn't have to go get more. I didn't have any legal consequences, but the emotional toll it was taking on me was terrible.
Well, if you've had a loss of trust with loved ones, that must have been very difficult, and that is not something you gain back quickly.
No, and in fact, my parents were very instrumental in talking with my husband and saying, this is out of control. And they were trying to figure out how to help. I saw it as them intruding in my life, but, you know, leave me alone. I can handle this myself. When I was really honest with myself, I knew I couldn't. But they did not stop. They were relentless in wanting me to get help, not letting me get away with it or turn their head, which, like I said, drove me deeper into hiding it, even though I wasn't doing a very good job of it.
Mm-hmm. Let's take a little break. You're listening to Real Recovery with Bill and George. Janet is our guest tonight, who's celebrated 8 years this week. We're excited to hear her story. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Real Recovery. Bill and George. We've got Janet as our guest tonight, celebrating her 8 years of sobriety this week, and we're very excited about that. And George, right before we went to break, Janet was talking about parents intervening, stepping in, trying to give some encouragement to the husband. And I know you've got some insightful thoughts about how helpful are the parents being at this point.
Yeah, I don't know how insightful this is, but she used the word helpful. And I never found it helpful when people were concerned about my chemical use. In fact, what happens, I think, Janet, a lot of times, and maybe this happened to you, is our core base of people are concerned. And so they share those concerns. And it kind of drives us away to where we're isolating from them too, because we don't feel it's helpful. Did that happen to you?
Absolutely. I mean, at the time, they were the enemy. I use the phrase helpful now, looking back. But My father sat me down, and he, on his own, had educated himself about alcoholism. He'd gotten his hands on a copy of the Big Book, and he read it cover to cover, and he said, listen, this program is for you, and this is, you'll find answers here. You're going to find help here. They set me up to talk with some people that they knew that that were in recovery. My husband went to my first AA meeting with me. And at the time it was like, okay, I'll do this to get them off my back. You know, I wish they'd leave me alone. But looking back, I do see it as they were trying everything they could. They were not going to just let this continue.
Your father read the Big Book?
I know, I'm stunned. That almost brought tears to my eyes.
Yeah, well, Billy, obviously, the Heavenly Father gave you an earthly father who loved you enough to tell you the truth and really get involved and investigate it, whether you wanted him to or not. Amazing.
Well, he truly knew. He just, his phrase was, how can she be so dumb? I mean, he could see it. Everybody around me could see it, and I wouldn't see it. And it went so far that my dad changed his will. He knew he did not have long on this earth because of his heart condition. And he changed his will and left money in his will to go for me to go to treatment. And ultimately, when he did pass away, I didn't know that. And my mom told me, this is what's going to happen, and this is what your dad wanted. And so because of that, even after his passing, I was able to go to treatment. And actually, my sobriety date, May 20th, is the one-year anniversary of my dad's passing. And so every year, I carry my current chip with me. So I have my eight-year chip, and then I take my previous years, and I go to the cemetery. And where you can pull up a vase from the gravestone, I put my previous year's coins in there, and that's where I keep them.
George, I'm either cutting up a raw onion in the studio right now, or I'm just getting very choked up over this.
That is just beautiful. Somehow, our dads were related, you know, and the fact the guy would put that in his will, mm-hmm. How great is that, you know, that God provides a way for us, because before we were born or your dad was born, he knew that would happen and that your dad would do that. And what strength of a dad, you know, you want your kids to love you, but you love them more than that need to be loved back, that you do that. And the fact that you go there, that's a beautiful story. I hope you share that a lot with people early in recovery and late in recovery, because it's just God all over it. It's beautiful.
It is beautiful. And he just knew from what he read in the Big Book and taught himself and interviewed people, he knew it would come to me needing treatment and that I couldn't do it alone. And he wanted to ensure that that would be available for me.
That's lovely. So when you started recovery, did you have a sponsor, a mentor? Did you have somebody that came alongside that was walking you through it?
Absolutely. I went to treatment, and it was set up through my mom and my physician as an intervention. And I went kicking and screaming to treatment. I kept saying, I can do it. And it was very clear I couldn't. And so I say treatment was my pilot light. That lit the pilot light that I've used to keep going. I was in a program for 30 days. And I stayed another 2 weeks beyond that. I was gone from my family over the holidays, over New Year. And I came back in early January. And I started shopping around for meetings and looking for a sponsor. And I tried almost every AA group I could go to see where I felt comfortable, where I felt connected to somebody who I asked to be my sponsor, and she's still my sponsor to this day. But I did have a relapse. I had a good couple months, and then I thought, I can handle one drink. Come on. And of course, that drink sent me over the edge, and very short time, I was back to drinking daily, heavily, hiding, and it was terrible. And I remember thinking, I can't do this. I'm not strong enough. And the reinforcement that I had received at treatment was, you can't do it alone. And I decided that I would take my dad's death on May 20th, and I would start taking Anabuse. On that day, I talked to my physician, and Anabuse is a prescription. It's a pill you take that if you do drink, it will make you very, very sick. I wanted to be on it. I chose to be on it. I convinced my physician that this is a tool and I need to take this. I need something externally with me at all times that I know I can't drink because my brain is too clever, sneaky, or dumb that temptation is too strong for me. So I started taking Anabuse, and I would take it every day. It was like a non-negotiable. And as a person who is very much wanting to be in control all the time, a control freak, I would look at that pill in the morning and say, I choose to take you because I want to have a full day of sobriety. And so that's how, rather than feeling like a defeated person who had to take it, I changed that energy into, I'm choosing to do this. I'm choosing to take this so I can have a life. And I took Anabuse for 2 years. I took it every day, never missed a day, always had my prescription refilled. And after 2 years, I thought, well, this is good. I'm able to handle this. And I went off of Anabuse, and the thoughts in my head came back so strong, and it was making me not enjoy my days because I was thinking, well, I could now, I could here, I could do this. I decided to go back on Anabuse for another year. And it was a tool that I needed, that I had the right mindset for, that I was ready to use, and it got me my firm footing into my life of sobriety.
I love that. There's a couple things here that I'd like to talk about. The relapse process can really mimic Genesis 3. Okay, I haven't had a drink in a while, I think 2 months. I really didn't have a problem. God didn't really say that. He just doesn't want you to be like him. And that process starts. But the fact you went to a lot of recovery meetings, a lot of people will tell me that I work with, they don't like recovery meetings. And I say, is it possible you don't like the meetings you've gone to? That it's kind of like going to church. You might go to a church you don't like, but you go to another one. Funny, if we go to a bar we don't like, we just go to another bar. That's a given. You finish your drink and you go to another one. But the Anabuse thing is a real commitment. And a lot of people will go on it, and they'll drink just to see how sick they get, which to a foreigner, a civilian who's not in the recovery world, that doesn't make any sense, but to us it does. But it's kind of like getting crutches for a broken leg.
Exactly.
If it helps you, I'm all for it, and I like your commitment. I choose to do this. Good for you. How long did you stay on it, or are you still on it?
No, I was on it for a total of 3 years, and I still have my last bottle of Anabuse where, if I ever felt tempted, I would go to that first rather than putting myself in a weird situation. But
sure.
I take every day, like we hear all the time, one day at a time. And I have such a fear of alcohol because I know what it does to me and the pull it will have on my life, which will be to suck it right down a drain. I choose to just keep myself armed with that if I ever need it. I'm very open about it with my family and my friends and my coworkers. And so they all know that this is a non-negotiable in my life.
Bill, when we get stories where people have long-term sobriety like this, the fundamentals are why they have it.
Mm-hmm.
I know what I need. I'm being honest with people around me. That's changed in the story. And I'm accountable. And when I feel like something's not working, like when I stopped taking my antabuse, it's okay for me to start again. And mm-hmm. and I tell people, and I'm not isolating, and I'm living in the truth, and I work with recovery people. That's why you're sober today. And it helps my program to hear people continue to do it, because there's a part of me that some days doesn't want to do it and confuses that with, I don't need to do it.
Right. And I see a lot of people in early recovery, you know, the first year, the first couple years. And then at meetings, there's a lot of old timers who have 15, 20, 30 years of sobriety. And I know that the danger for me to say is, oh, I got this. You know, I've got 8 years. I don't need to go to meetings. But I also know, no, I do need to go to meetings. I need to remind myself and be with people who get it and hear the stories and tell my story, because it is the crux of my life. If I don't have my sobriety, I'm not going to have anything else. I'm not going to have my job, my kids, my husband. Everything will go. And so even at 8 years, I continue to go to the two meetings a week that work for me, that I have built these relationships and that I love going to these meetings. And it's something I look forward to.
And Janet, have you had a chance to start obviously investing in other people's lives and maybe sponsoring others?
I have. I sponsor a woman who is coming up on 4 years.
Awesome.
And I have worked with other women who have invested in the program and drifted away and then want to come back to the program. So, and I see myself in them. And, you know, it's just not their time. They're not ready yet. And they know I'm here. The program's here. All of us are here when and if they do choose to come back. So I relish the successes. And I understand those that are struggling.
Mm-hmm. All right, we'll take a little break. We're listening to Janet's story, celebrating 8 years this week on Thursday. What a happy, happy occasion. You're listening to Real Recovery. Bill and George, we'll be right back. Welcome back. We're so glad to have Janet on the show tonight. If you've missed any of this, you're going to definitely want to go to myfaithradio.com, and you can listen to the broadcast, and you can do that without written permission of Major League Baseball. You can just listen to it or pass it on. Whenever you want to do that, you can. And if you have a friend that you know would be blessed by this story, you can email them the link and let them know you're thinking about them. So, Janet, we're curious to see, too, how life is now, 8 years under your belt, and what family life is like and church life and everything else.
Sure. Family life is incredible. My husband has been amazing through this. And one of the things we say to each other almost on a daily basis is, this is better. He used to say that to me every day during the first year, this is better. And we still say it to this day. Our kids are now 10 and 11. They have no memory of mom with a drink in her hand, and we have no alcohol in our home. So I know they're getting to the age now where I'm going to want to share with them my journey, my story, and finding the right time to do that. I know that will be coming soon. The kids know I go to meetings. And my daughter said, what do you do at these meetings? And I said, well, we talk. And they're meetings to make me a better wife, a better mother. And she knows they're at churches and that I carry a big book with me.
Mm-hmm.
And that she said, is that a Bible? I said, yeah, it is a type of a Bible. Because it's a guide to living my life. And we have a church that we're very strong in and our small group, and we're very open with them. They know my story. They know our journey, and that I'm somebody they can reach out to if they have a friend or a family member who's struggling, that I'm always willing to meet for a cup of coffee with someone and talk about it, whether it's the family members that are struggling or the person themselves, who I can just share with them my experience, strength, and hope.
Janet, it's sweet that you become sort of a resource person for people in your small group, because not only can you have discussions with them about the need to take that first step into a meeting, but it's also you can share the love of Jesus with them as well and tell them that they're probably also looking for something that their soul is not satisfied with yet.
Absolutely. And it is through faith. It is a program where I have reconnected with my higher power, and it moves me beyond anything that my human brain can comprehend. And the grace of God that was shown to me and the grace that I extend to others is so beautiful and so crucial to my recovery.
All right, George, if you don't have any questions, I've got another couple of questions for Janet. The only bummer about not being in the studio with George is we don't see each other. And for all I know, he went to get a cup of coffee or something. So you still there, George? Maybe he's not. That's very funny. So, Janet, when you are reaching out and you have people that say, I've got a sister or my wife is struggling, what is the best way to reach out to them in a way that is not going to be threatening? Because there's a lot of people I know that want to help others. They don't know how to do it.
Right. It gets tricky. And I know my defenses were pretty high, and I didn't want to meet with people and talk about it. My parents were trying to arrange that. I think what helped is when I did meet with somebody who is in recovery, they would share, you don't want to live like this and you don't have to. And it was that reaching out of compassion, because I was struggling. I was exhausted, but I didn't see a way out. I didn't know how I could lose this companion of alcohol and still be able to be calm. I didn't know that there was a community. I didn't understand that I had extreme anxiety. So when I reach out to somebody, I really share that you don't have to live like this. Rather than feeling attacked, that person then feels like, oh, this person understands that this is hard. This is not how somebody wants to live their life. And that was really meaningful to me. And I remember that, and I use that when I'm talking to somebody.
Yeah, I'm always wondering what the blend is between tough love and a gentle invitation, which you seem to do quite well.
Well, I try. The way the program works is I can share my story, and if somebody hears something in there that speaks to them or reminds them of how good life can get without alcohol, then that's the seed I can plant with that person. And ultimately, when somebody is ready to quit drinking, if they have that support and they choose to engage in recovery meetings and to surround themselves and protect themselves by sharing what they're going through, it's so much easier. In fact, I laugh that I was at a at work. Over the years, I've told my coworkers and shared my story with them. And there was one time I was at a board meeting, and at the end of the board meeting, they were passing around champagne for a toast. And my boss looked at me and winked and brought me a glass that she said, it's fine. And it was sparkling cider. But my colleagues around the table didn't know that she had gone to this extent. And so I had now my colleagues staring at me thinking I was drinking a glass of champagne, that my boss had set aside his cider, and I was getting daggers from a lot of my coworkers who didn't want to say anything because we were at a board meeting, but they were terrified for me. And so afterward, it was all made clear, but it was a really strange moment where I had people looking out for me in the middle of a situation that was safe, but they didn't know, and it touched me.
That's beautiful because there's so much loving accountability there. That's a beautiful thing.
Mm-hmm. It truly is.
Oh, George, you back yet?
Yeah, I've always been here.
No, you weren't. you disappeared for a little while.
Well, the show improved a little.
I'm just saying.
That's kind of like my life. I check out occasionally. The problem is I always come back. I like the part about the attraction rather than promotion. If you show up and you do what the other people are doing, people are going to see something in you they want. And it's such a great thing in that for a lot of us, that was the first time in my life where I felt truly accepted. Because
absolutely.
When I go to church, and I love going to church, I got to be in my best behavior and present my best self rather than who I am. And in recovery, they don't shoot, they're wounded, you know?
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There was an open embrace and immediate understanding.
Plus, these people are as messed up as I am, which is really a relief. And if you want to meet the people that partied too hard and had to quit, that's who these people are. And you'll find people you have a lot in common with. It's fabulous.
Exactly. And I choose meetings where the feeling is upbeat, supportive. We are laughing a lot. And it is a time every week to celebrate that we have chosen this life and that we know that our higher power is in control, and it is a great true freedom in recovery that I found with my groups and with the people around me and with my family.
Janet, I know that when you started, I know that you knew it was going to be one day at a time. Did you ever think you'd be sitting here 8 years later going, I've got my 8-year anniversary this week, just had it?
It goes so fast.
Okay.
And I don't count days and minutes and hours, and I truly was able to relax into my life. Those first few years, it was hard. It was a daily struggle. And what's beautiful now is that I go, oh my gosh, 8 years. And continuing just every day to love where I'm at in life, love my family, and know that my sobriety is key in this, to just be able to enjoy my life mm-hmm. and not be running and hiding and sneaking and lying. And it's so beautiful.
We only have about a minute left. Can you give a quick word of encouragement to someone listening tonight who might be a little bit in that delusional state?
You know in your gut.
You know.
and you're scared because alcohol has served its purpose for you for a long time, but you do get to a place where you know in your gut this isn't working, and I want to be free of this monster. To pay attention to that, reach out, find groups. There's so much online. There's so much right in your neighborhood with programs and people. There's no reason to hide.
Great.
I hid that I was an alcoholic for a long time, and now I'm able to say, hey, this is my life, this is my story, and I'm proud of where I'm at, and I'm so grateful.
Thanks, Janet. It's been great. That wraps up our show for the night. Have a great night, everyone. We'll see you next week. And so I have to say before I go. Thanks for listening. Programming like this is made available through your support. Information available at myfaithradio.com.